O Modernist, celebrating of aging, a deeper wisdom, igniting sparks in the gray matter. Well, we have been developing the theme this week of celebrating aging by giving attention to the thesis that the Christ for all ages calls us to celebrate aging by becoming centers of a greater freedom, a deeper wisdom, and a wider love. And the first day we took the word becoming and tried to take a look at how the stages of life become the opportunities for us to fulfill some new adventure under God's plan for us, making friends with time. Time is not an enemy, time is God's blessing. The second day we talked about centering, a center, a place to hang your heart that gives you enough confidence to take the risk of doing this becoming business, of launching out into new things. And yesterday we talked about a greater freedom. Don't fence me in. Don't let the years build fences around you. Today we want to do the fourth of those key words to that thesis statement, that the celebrating of aging involves becoming centers for a deeper wisdom, igniting sparks in the gray matter. Now, it's been interesting to me to notice how some of the themes of the various sessions here have come together. On one day, David Bella came to me after we did Erik Erikson's stages of development and said that as one who is observing what happens in technology, where during the work stage your principal quality to develop is that of competence, that so many through the work years have given the total devotion of their life to competence that and are experts in their given vocations and fields, but have not paid attention to the other qualities of life, such as intimacy and care and relationships, that also make up the wholeness of life. And so in the end, are not prepared to capture that which Erikson says is at the end of the ladder for old age, the quality of wisdom itself, which has to integrate all of these. And Elena, you were talking about the same thing of, you know, the balance of your own being and your work world and your relationship world, that those who are so involved in their work world, where competence is important, and we don't disparage that, but find and Bella backed this up too, saying that very often that involves working with machines and a kind of competence that once you reach it, sort of even before you retire, starts to be boring and not life satisfying. And then because there's been no attention to any other of the dimensions of life, when retirement comes, the boredom becomes even greater and the quality of life decreases. Somehow we have this sort of inverted U-shaped plan for life in our society, youth for education, middle years for work, and old age for obsolescence. And what we're trying to do is change that and see that there are new adventures along the way. Our biblical base for this is found in 1 Corinthians, the first chapter, in verse 18, where Paul writes, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever. I will, in the cleverness of the clever, I will thwart. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and folly to Gentiles, But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Paul in Ephesians goes on in another passage, just a few verses of the first chapter. For he has made known to us in all wisdom the insight of the mystery of his will, according to his purpose which he set forth in Christ as a plan for the fullness of time, to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. We noted yesterday in talking about human nature that as self-transcendent beings who must have some meaning and purpose in life, some plan. And I guess the secret of successful aging is to find out, you know, what the game of life is all about before the game is over, to get in on the mystery of the purpose that God has for our human existence. And if you note that Paul says in 1 Corinthians that in the Christ for all seasons that we've been talking about, we can find not only that wisdom, what is the plan and the mystery that of God's plan for the ages and for us individually, but we can also find the power of God. Now, wisdom is not just head knowledge, but it is wisdom that is able to implement in life that which is known through knowledge of simply the plan. I liken it to what happened for the football players when the coach comes in for the sessions. He takes the chalk on the blackboard and outlines the play that they are to learn, and according to it's done on the blackboard, it's all every play is a touchdown play if everyone executes, you know, what they're supposed to do, and yet in the game itself it's never that way. It's not enough to have a plan. It's important to have power to execute the plan. And Paul is saying that in Christ we not only have the plan, but we are given the power of God, by which to execute that that plan of life. The difference between simply head knowledge, head wisdom, and the actual power to execute, what a difference it is. You know the difference between knowledge, to be a walking encyclopedia, is not the same as having wisdom. And you move from knowledge to wisdom. Wisdom includes knowledge, but it's able to apply it to life itself. And so that's what we're going to try to do as we take a look at what are the potentials for growing in wisdom with age. The old cliche, you know, old too soon, smart too late. That's not always true. I want to share with you this morning some of the things that I have learned from older adults that really came through in life to wisdom. This I learned while living for a year up with the retirement community with the Ebenezer Society, where I had the pleasure of knowing Alina's uncle, Pastor Halverson, and most of the wisdom came from him as we sat at dinner, and I shared some of that with you yesterday with the story of the butts. But some of the other places, as I worked in the nursing homes with those who had aged gracefully and matured in wisdom. Erik Erikson, who puts at the end of the stages of development the battle between integrity and despair, of which he says the outcome is wisdom, says, if integrity wins out over despair, the result is wisdom. That wisdom is an informed and detached concern with life itself in the face of death. It's the opposite of disdain. The antipathy of wisdom is the feeling of seeing in others an increasing state of being finished, confused, helpless. Those are the options. They're terrible. The option at the other end of the spectrum, which you often observe at the end of the line for many people. Henry Nouwen, who was referred to this morning in the Matins in the dining room, writes, "When aged have come to terms with their own aging and death, they have something to teach those who have not reached that stage of the life cycle. In a strange reversal, we find that while we assign those in the nursing home to the world of unreality, the truth of the matter is that our whole culture is sick because it's living in an illusory world." Well, what are the implications of that, do you think? What really has happened with those in the nursing home, they have come to grips with the fact that we are finite creatures. And they have come to grips with the fact that as finite creatures, we shall die. And yet, in the face of that reality, which we, you know, by pushing them out of the way into the nursing homes, fail to learn from them, going through the terrible rituals that we do with funerals to hide the reality of aging, we're trying to hide reality, escape from reality. And they have wisdom. They have, because they're not living in an illusory world, they're living in the world of reality, and they have something to teach us. And what a tragedy it is then when we separate, you know, the elderly from the young people so that the young people no longer have the opportunity to learn from them. The Old Testament recognized this, as in Proverbs and in so many other places. The elderly were the sources of wisdom in the community. And we could go to the Proverbs and show how this is true. The admonition, get wisdom, get insight, profit from it. In the Mishnah, it says, learning from the aged is like drinking old wine. We lived in China for a few years where the elderly were in the community as the source of wisdom for the young. They had, you know, as you go up an elevator on the outside of a building, they have a hotel like that in San Francisco, the higher you go, the more you see. And the elderly have so much to teach us. We had the privilege in our home of having our grandparents live with us. And what I learned, you know, from my grandfather and my grandmother through those years. My grandmother was one of those caring persons who baked lefse to support a missionary worker in Madagascar. And she did baptismal clothes for all the people on the other side of the track so they'd get their children over there. What a person. Well, that is so often missed, it seems to me, when we separate the generations. Some examples of this greater wisdom. This I wanted to say yesterday, but I ran out of time. I think I learned from those people in the nursing home more about the exercise of greater freedom than I learned in working with college students. You know, I was quite a transition from teaching 1 year with college students, having all their options open to them. Not quite so easy today, and so I don't want to exaggerate that. But, you know, they seem to have so many potentials, so many freedoms of this vocation. And as I've talked with college students, I remember when we sat up in the Bosphorus with some students on the Middle East term, where we saw those narrows that they had to go through in order to go out into the wider expanse of the Mediterranean, and that there's a narrowing of a decision where they have to cut off their options. And the one girl says, "Oh, I can't make up those minds. There's so many things I want to do that I have to cut out if I'm going to go to medical school or if I'm going to go to seminary." They seem to have so many options as being their problem. But I think the elderly who I worked with in the nursing homes, in the retirement centers, really because over against the limitations that they were experiencing, were still having the inner resources to exercise and find new opportunities and new possibilities, I found greater strength of freedom among them than among the college students. Or a more testing of their initiative was certainly there than what was required of the college students. And so I learned the possibility that there could be greater freedom. Now, what did this come out of for these remarkable elderly people? I think they had learned the wisdom that's at the heart of the Holden theme this year, that life is a gift, not to be possessed, but to be celebrated and to be enjoyed, not to be held on to. The first evening we came in, or Sunday evening service, the sermon by John emphasized this same truth, that we don't need to hold on and to possess and control anything, because life is not ours as a possession to protect, but life is a gift. These elderly, these splendid seniors, or whatever you want to call them, that when you would go in to minister to them, they would minister to you because they had learned this one secret of life, the secret of how to let go. And isn't life, you know, a whole series of letting go of one thing as you have to move on to something else? There I met those and visited with those who had let go of a spouse. They'd had to let go of their home, which they'd lived in and loved. Some of them had said to let go of children, of friends, of health itself, and yet they were not defeated. It wasn't that they didn't enjoy these things and celebrate these things, but they realized that they were not theirs to hold or to keep. They were not their possessions. They were gifts to be enjoyed at the time, and to learn that with every letting go, there is another gift of God that is available to you. And the gifts of God that were available and manifest in these people were those inner gifts of inner resources of courage and of love and of faithfulness and of hope. And with those gifts, they ministered and gave to us, you know, who came in contact with them, to celebrate life as a gift. And not that they did not mourn, and not that it was not difficult to let go, but to realize that life was not based on the possession of things, but on celebrating the gifts of life. Another way of stating this is given in a letter that Larry Rasmussen, our program director, he's coming back from his backpacking today, so we'll get to visit with him, in a newsletter said to us, the celebrating of aging, the celebrating of life, means life as a gift of God, and a kind of joyous defiance of death in all its frightening forms. What would it mean if we had a sacramental view of life rather than a utilitarian one? The latter says that the life and the world are a problem set, and we are problem solvers who either get it right or undo ourselves, and nature and society in the process. But if you look at the New Testament, is there not there a drama of being caught up in life in the power of the Spirit and the formation of the new community that is itself a kind of sacrament, a gift, a coming of a new age? That's the lesson we need to learn. And Henry Nouwen again writes, he says, of the tragedy of, you know, separating this knowledge from youth. He says, much violence in our society is based on the illusion of immortality, which is the illusion that life is a property to be defended and not a gift to be shared. When the elderly no longer can bring us in contact with our own aging, we quickly start playing dangerous power games to uphold the illusion of being ageless and immortal. And he says it's a tragedy when the elderly don't have contact with the young to teach them this lesson because they don't have anyone to be on the receiving end, and it's a tragedy for the children and for the younger people not to learn from them. Another way of putting the implications of this, Evelyn and James Whitehead, who write on retirement, say that at the heart of Christianity is the celebration of uselessness. You have to see what they mean by that. That we are not sufficient unto our own salvation. Our lives, our relationships with God are a gift. We have not generated ourselves. We cannot, in the end, justify ourselves. I do not have to do anything to be loved by God, to be a part of the community of faith. We can celebrate an emptying out of credentials and a celebration of the grace-filled uselessness of the children of God. Now, not that we become useless, but that there is something of being, you know, not making the uses to which we put our lives the basis for justifying our own existence. Another implication, of course, is this, that not only we are not dependent upon our own merits and our own work, but we're not dependent on our possessions. We can, as Calvin says, you know, he was not an ascetic. He enjoyed the gifts of life and the good things, but he says that I'm not tied to them. I sit loose over against them. So when they do go, I don't go with them. Those are the great gifts that come from the wisdom of knowing that life is a gift. Some other wisdom that I've learned from the elderly, this not through personal contact, but through reading the book with Paul Tournier. Some of you know him as the Swiss doctor. And in this, Learning to Grow Old, he writes of his own experience of retirement. And he said one of the first things he had to learn, and it took him a long time, that you have to learn to live with the unfinished. He had so many professional goals he wanted to accomplish, but the time came when he'd say, well, I just can't do all of that. He come to terms with the limits we talked about of time itself. You're willing to live with the unfinished. I told the story of the old lady who was dying in the retirement center in Evanston, who said, I'm not going to die in that damned old bed. And she sat there knitting away as the chaplain came in and died there that afternoon. And a significant part of the story that I didn't add yesterday was that her daughter picked up that knitting and finished it for her. There are others who can finish the work that we leave unfinished. Well, the other thing that I was impressed with by Tournier's relating of his own experience of retirement was that he was told by these very pious people that, you know, you probably should, you know, now sort of prepare for death, to be like grandma sitting in her rocking chair reading the Bible to prepare for her final exams and get ready for death. And he says, oh, he says, I don't know why I should be any less interested in the world today when I'm old than when I was young. Afterwards, after all, you know, it's God's good creation given to us in joy. And he says, you know, as far as getting ready for death, I guess I have to leave that in God's hands anyway. Not much I can do about that. And so having come to terms with that, he lived to the full those years. There's some wisdom, I think, in that. I want to shift gears now to talk about another dimension of this wisdom, of how the opportunities for learning and growing in wisdom can be a lifelong enterprise. This part of igniting sparks in the gray matter, by which we fight boredom, one of the crises of later life. I do this on the basis of some experience at working in continuing education at the Ebenezer Society, But I would like to start out with the statement from the book You Never Are Too Old to Learn by Cross and Florello. The traditional notion that education is a preparation for life is giving way to the realization that learning is an integral part of life itself, that it is an enriching, challenging, and rewarding experience that begins with the first spark of curiosity and continues as long as that spark remains alight. And keep the spark there. And then they go on to tell the story of Liz Bustamante in New York, who was bored to death after retirement and decided, boy, I'm going to have to light the spark. And she went back to a technical school and learned how to be a welder. And she says the first week she was there, she didn't know anything about it. She didn't even know how to spark the torch. But she not only learned how to spark the torch for welding, but it created such an interest in her of other adventures that not only did she continue her welding so that she had sculptures that were displayed all over in New York in the museums, but she took up the study of foreign languages and traveled and so forth. She found a way to ignite the spark. And this is to recognize what Alfred North Whitehead, the philosopher, said, that reason is, he says, to promote the art of life. Speculative thought in itself is one of the dimensions of the good life. Reason has the power to preserve order and yet introduce novelty. Thus it stands in opposition to fatigue, boredom, despair, which is the dissipation of life through boredom. So reason is a part of the good life by which we continue to overcome boredom and find new adventures. Now, to report a little bit on what fun we had working up at Ebenezer, I just duplicated a short summary of it that I wrote up for the Lutheran Standard, and some of these things you may want to look at, but I have some interest in moving to the applications of this for not only for us as individuals, but for some of you who work in congregations. You can send those around and look at them later if you care to, and as far as they go. the pastor reported that he had a gentleman in his congregation who was 80 years of age, who was there for every adult class and every learning opportunity there was. And the pastor asked him, you know, how is it that you are so interested in all of these things that are happening here? And his response was this: well, when the time comes, when I may in some way be confined, when I can't run around in person, I will be able to run around in my mind. And Peter Ustinov, he took up the pursuit of the arts later in life and asked why. He says, in my opinion, most of us live within our minds. And if that is where I'm going to live, I'm going to see that it's a fit place to live. So how do you go about igniting some sparks in the gray matter? You realize, I talk about this as the possibility for a church's role in this. There's a new situation with the elderly in our day that makes this even more important. The average city dweller over 65 at the present time has had no more than an eighth grade education. 23 million over 65 today, one-fourth of them had less than eighth grades. The median was for all of the elderly was to have gone through 9.5 years of school. Now those in the 45 to 54 bracket already have, with required education now, have 12 and a half years of education, a little bit beyond high school. So there's coming, you know, a group with more education, and that should have possibly more interest in this. I must relate to you, one of the buildings that Ebenezer, that they managed, was the Teachers Retirement Center, and where we tried to introduce continuing education. And they fought it tooth and nail for 2 years. They were the least interested. And those in their other, and the low-income residents in which we lived, where I suppose the medium education was much lower, were the ones who jumped at it and made the greatest use of it. So it isn't necessarily that those who have had more education are the ones that are interested in still growing. I don't know, maybe teachers have had enough. Our last.
And this hurting person sitting here and another hurting person sitting there and so forth. I went to our young pastor and suggested starting an interdenominational Bible study for the men, the retired men. There was already one for the women. And with the sole purpose of getting these men started on visitation to hurting people, even visiting one another. Now when we left, we still only had about 7 people attending, but I was very happy to see on the last Sunday I was at church, 2 of these men buttonholed a new widower and inviting him in and encouraging him for visitation. They themselves have all...
Our class, they lost some spark someplace. The third year they came in on the program, though, so it had to be proved to them. And what we find is that with Elder Hostel, I'm sure most of you are acquainted with that, where the elderly come to our campuses and live in the dormitories for a week and take 2 or 3 courses, that some studies have been made of that, that those with lower degrees of previous academic training, schooling, are the ones who appreciate it the most and who gain the most. So I just think there's a whole new age coming for this opportunity within the church. Some changes in the length of life and so forth make this very important. Our president of the Ebenezer Society at Harold Norby had come from having built a community in Lincoln, Nebraska, and he was excited about the possibility of, he sort of was opposed to everything that was being done in our old segregation ways of taking care of elderly and so forth. And he suggested to us once in one of our meetings, what if we could build an intergenerational community in which there was the possibility for the generations to mix, but everyone to have a mix like what of some work, productive work, not necessarily paid work, but some work with their hands even, some continued education opportunities and some creative recreation to make that mix of life through that. We need to do some new thinking in our planning for those retirement years. How this would stand up over against senility, if you can teach the young. Well, if you can teach. His mother was out there in India, wasn't she, in her later years? Right. Too. Yes.
Very much more modest.
There are those who tell us that the potential for learning is still there. Eric Pfeiffer, a psychiatrist at Duke, says the best way to avoid senile dementia is to find regular intellectual stimulation. Then he goes on to say, after middle age, our brain begins to die. Cells expire, and they're not replaced. That's true. Is that, Ralph, is that correct, that the cells of the brain do not reproduce after a certain stage? You start losing your brain cells, and they're not recreated like most of our body cells recreate themselves, and so we have an entirely new body every 7 years, I guess. So you're not the same old carcass you were before. You got a whole set of new cells, but the brain cells start to die, and they're not reproduced. So that, but then he goes on, that the challenge that this means is that you have to use to the limit what is left, or face senility. And the encouraging thing, a part of it, is that he finally says, you know, that all through life we use but a very, very small percentage of the potential of our brain capacity. And so there's plenty there left in the gray matter to have some sparks ignited. In the studies of memory, what we did at the Ebenezer retirement homes was, and they had 3-4 residences and 5 nursing homes, recognizing that there were not the opportunities for them to come to the campus for elder hostel. We took elder hostel to them. We survey of what they were interested in and gave them a list of their committees, made a list of 20 things they thought they would be interested in. We took one survey and reduced it down to 10 and sent that back as 10 potential courses. And then on the second survey, we took the 3, 4, 5 top ones and offered them and a class and found the professor to match the subject matter and got enrollment. They paid $10 tuition for a 5-session course. They were interested enough to invest something in it. We had scholarships if they couldn't afford it in the low income and nursing homes. But they did this. And one of the more successful or interesting courses was that taught by our psychologist on memory. We met one of our old friends up there when that was being taught, and she was saying, oh, that's such an interesting course on memory. And I said, well, I hadn't heard about it. I said, who's teaching you? Oh, she said, I can't remember. Maybe it was just the first session. They tell us that the capacity for memory and new learning is still there, but you have much more to remember when you're older, and there's a lot of things you don't want to remember. I remember when they had those $64,000 questions where you'd ask, and you're supposed to know all this, and you know, one of my friends said, you wouldn't be caught dead with knowing the answers to all those questions, carrying all that lumber around in his mind of things and dates and facts that were not important. But elderly can remember those things that are significant and relevant to them. And one thing more you need to know when you work with the elder in education, you can't get by with any chaff. You can't fool them. They want the real stuff. And so there is, for that which is significant, there is the power to retain memory and response of being able to continue to grow. We have a psychiatrist working in the medical school at the University of Minnesota by the name of Brantner, an elderly gentleman himself who serves on our board at Ebenezer. He says, how do you prepare for old age? You can't. You can only prepare for change. How to let go, how to grab hold of other things. He asked an 8-year-old girl, what are you going to be? And her answer was, there's no name yet for that what I'm going to be. That's the kind of world we're living in. Things rarely turn out the way we want them to, the way that we expect them. But to be open, curious, that's a great gift of life. I see at least four areas in which we could do significant work in continuing education in congregations and in any community setting cooperatively through schools, senior centers, or what you have. One purpose is education simply for the satisfaction it gives to know for the sake of knowing. The realization that this is God's world and to know more about God's world in itself. No ulterior financial motive or anything else, but just an enrichment. You know, some of you that have come here and made decisions to come here must have some of that spirit in you. a second possibility, I think, my wife and I have been involved in it some, is education for retirement. That when both for the financial planning and for the life plan, you know, some of that should take place at 45, 50, 55, 60, and congregations should be helping their people prepare for fruitful retirement or planning for that last third of life as it might come out to be with the extended life stage. Aid Association for Lutherans has a smart retirement program which we're trainers for, and that's available through their branches, and there are a variety of those things where you can think through those things. Not exactly the same thing, but I think congregations should help prepare for widowhood and have some help for widows in that stage that comes in their life so that they share these things and meet these crises together. That is a particular dimension of it. But more important, I think, for the congregation, and I'm thinking not of adult education for for the elderly, but for all the adults in our church. I really feel that we in the church do such a rotten job. We send our kids to confirmation and we let it go there, and it's education for what I call discipleship, which means that to learn more of what is the implications of the Christian faith for our lifestyle and for fulfilling our Christian vocation, which we're going to talk about tomorrow. What makes, you know, if I may just share an illustration out of my own pastoral experience. I was a pastor in Chicago for 5 years up on the Northwest side. We'd left, and I was at St. Olaf at the time of the great civil rights movement, but we saw on TV one night the Martin Luther King march out to Cicero, up Laramie Avenue, which came right through my community. It was a very strong Polish Catholic neighborhood, but we were a small little church there. But the whole community, if you remember back to that days, they were out there in the streets throwing rocks and bottles. And I saw some of my people there too. And I wondered, you know, what had we been doing in that church for 50 years? That somehow they did not have any better sense of what Christian discipleship was in terms of our race relationships than to be there on that scene at that time. We'd failed them. It was an indictment of the church that we hadn't sort of taken them to the place to realize the implications of our discipleship. Well, I suppose most popular topics for our people in the retirement centers were the courses in religion, and they really took tough courses, and they didn't get credit for these courses, but they were of an academic nature, and it showed that there was the interest and the capacity to pursue the implications of the faith. And the other thing, and this relates, I suppose, also to the story I just told, that there should be education for social and civic responsibility, for fulfilling our duties as Christian citizens. The other topic of most interest was that of politics. We had a course before the election on the office of the presidency, and we had a political science professor who was able to teach the course without letting down whether he was a Republican or a Democrat. but confront the issues. And we did one on the great decisions in international politics and on what's happening in Cuba and South America. And they were interested in these issues. And I suppose I'm not quite sure that this is statistically correct because I didn't write it down, but someone told me once that the largest percentage of voters of any age group are with the elderly today, and so that they are carrying important civic responsibility, and to have an informed citizenry who studies the issues. And so that, along with preparing for Christian discipleship through nurture and the study of our faith, along with a knowledge of the issues, and that's what I see sort of Holden is about and is the kind of mix that I like to see, that we look at the whole of life. I suppose those are the four that I was thinking of. Education simply for the joy of knowing, education, preparation for retirement, for widowhood, education for Christian discipleship, education for civic responsibility. But after listening to Elena the other night, I thought, well, we should open up the possibility that there should be exploration and there are opportunities for preparation for new careers, even at the retirement age. I don't know, maybe you would care to comment on that. There are some, and I'm interested, you know, of seeing if now at 65 this year for me, whether I can start a new career. I little don't know, I can't resolve that issue, but if so, I'd have to get probably some special training, and that there should be opportunity. But for the most part in congregations, I don't think we can do that. That would be technical type of training within some academic community, I suppose. And I don't think we need to give degrees and credits for all these courses that we offer. But let's talk about some of this. Well, just finally, some suggestions for individuals. Those were congregational things. If boredom is taken over in your life, how could you ignite the spark again? If self-motivation seems to be lacking, and when all the good intentions never get fulfilled, when you might have started some new adventure, but your interest has not been sustained, and the original enthusiasm is gone, and the gas is running out. Well, Richard Bowles, in his Three Boxes of Life, suggests that you sit down and list the 10 things most important to you in life. What really has been important? What has thrilled you formerly as a student, or in the church, or in the community, a political issue that you've been involved in? List those things. And over against that, in a second column, put down how your study relates to it, one or more or three of those things that you have some enthusiasm about. And see what you are doing and what could be done to know more about that. And then you bring to the top where your own enthusiasms are. Some need that you're excited about, that you see in the community that should be fulfilled and that you could be involved in, and yet just comment about it and don't do anything about it. What could you do to respond to that need? And then, after surfacing those top interests that really excite you, ignite some sparks, then try to find a community of interested other people to share that with you and to give you support in your sustained interest in this new endeavor. Can you find some new projects to take hold of, some new issues to pursue, so that boredom does not take over? Well, that's all I have to say. I'd just like to close by going back to the sort of the biblical basis again, that the inspiration for this, it seems to me, comes from the freedom to risk and to grow through the Christ for all seasons. And I like the poem of John Masefield, The Everlasting Mercy, where he writes, "O glory of the lighted mind, the one that's been sparked, how dead I'd been, how dumb, how blind. The station brook to my new eyes was babbling out of paradise. The waters rushing from the rain were singing, Christ has risen again. I thought all earthly creatures knelt from rapture of the joy I felt. O glory of the lighted mind. Well, so much. Now, I'm interested in finding out from you what you are up to, those of you who are in that stage of life of retirement, or you from one of the congregation here, your three Ammers, I guess, more mature.
What is it? More mature members.
More mature members, all right. Some of you are from the Sioux City group. What do you call your group? The Adventures?
Adventures.
Ms. Malice, would you tell us something about what you've been up to since working with this group? You're the originator, they tell me.
Well, maybe at the offset, I should tell you that I have always been a very poor person, the daughter of a tailor, and coming from Norway, and we had six children in our family, and so it took many, many stitches of my father's to keep us in stitches. And so as a result, we went and got our high school education, and by the time I was 17 years old, I had never been any farther away from Sioux City than Elk Point, South Dakota, 28 miles. And I got my first job at the Livestock National Bank and was making, I think, $14.25 a week under the NRA program. Well, I always managed to save a little bit of that money after paying my mother board and room and paying my tithe, as we had been trained to do. And I saved a little bit of money so that about the second year that I had worked, I took a trip. And it was in 1934, and the World's Fair in New York was going on. And I saw for the first time what was on the other side of the fence, and I liked it. And so then it was an all-expense-paid tour from Chicago to New York and back, $75 for a whole week. And so then the next year, I saved some more money, and I took another trip. And so from 1934 to 1960, I traveled on my vacation every year. And so then, I think it was 1960, my father helped me plan my first trip to Norway, and that was just a delight. 64, I did a Holy Land tour on my own, joined a group, however. 67, I took the Luther Reformation tour into Germany and so forth. And by 68, I had been approached by someone, and they asked me, why are you still paying for your vacations? And I wondered what he was talking about. At this time, I was working in radio and television, and I was well established, had my own show on the air, and was doing some commercials, and so I was pretty satisfied with myself and my occupation. But when he said, why are you still paying for your own vacations as much as you have traveled, I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you're ready to either go to work for someone or start your own business, which really then, that was the spark that ignited the Adventures Travel Club. I went to my boss and I talked with him about it, and he said, well, you can't go wrong if you take your vacation and try it out and see if you like it, which I did. I created the first tour, which was a six-day tour through the state of Iowa. We were, and I covered everything that was of interest in the state of Iowa in 6 days. The next year, Iowa tour and did a Colorado tour. Now it was really getting under my skin. Really liked what I was doing. I've always sort of enjoyed details and having control of a situation, which might even be to my undoing someday. I don't know. I'm sure learning that this week. Watch out about too much control. And so then by 1970, the tail was wagging the dog, and I had to do something then. So I quit my job, and it was a faith venture, I must say. The whole thing was dedicated to the Lord, because I have been a Christian all my life, as far as I know. I've come into a new dimension of Christianity in the last 4 or 5 years, which is such a delightful experience for me, but I have always been a Christian. And so even my camera was dedicated to the Lord. When I went on these trips, so that he would take the pictures he wanted me to share with others. And as a result, I gave travelogues through the years that I was working, and my name was synonymous with travel. By 1970, yes, then I saw it was necessary that I quit my job, and we incorporated as a travel club and started from scratch. All these people are members of the travel club. You pay a total of $5 for a single membership, lifetime membership, $7.50 for a husband and wife. You're on the mailing list, and you get the mailings for whatever we do and wherever we go. I say it was a very humble beginning, which necessitated my getting a lawyer and a tax consultant and a few things like that. But we started with a zero number of members, and we now have a total of over 5,000 members in the United States. And they join us from Chicago and New York and from all over, and we're going places like Holden, and meet us en route, and away we go. It is not an easy life, I must grant you. Now, this is my full-time job now. I should be retiring. My brothers and sisters tell me, why don't you lessen your activities? But I just can't. I have too much of an enthusiasm to go, and I have a zest for living, and I want everybody to see as much as I have seen. That is my greatest desire in keeping on. I'm going to be 69 years old in November, and I have no intentions of stopping, and I don't really know how my strength is going to keep up with my desires and my mind, but the Lord knows all of that, and it's in His hands, I'm sure. We go overseas, we take everything from one-day trips to 23 and 24-day trips. We have been to the major countries of the world, the Orient and Australia, New Zealand, the Scandinavian, Europe, the Holy Land, Russia, Mediterranean cruises, Caribbean cruises, everything from there on down to the little one-day trips that we go to the Corn Palace in Mitchell, South Dakota, show and shopping tours in Omaha, weekends to Shakopee for the Renaissance, Minneapolis for Chan House and Dinner Theater and so on and so forth. Everything from the long trips down to the 1 and 2 and 5 day trips. There is no end to what you can do when you see the need of it, as Elena told us the other night. The great thing that you must look for is where there is a need. And I found that when people are 25 and 30 years old, they're raising their kids, they're paying off mortgages for their houses and their cars and so forth, it's not until you get to be about 50 years old when you have any money and any time to do anything for yourself. That seems to be the schedule. And so as a result, most of the people that travel with me, I'd say the greatest percentage of people that travel with me are 50 and over. However, we have a lot of young couples now that are going, guys who don't want to do the driving anymore, and so they say, well, let's just buy a tour and go. And they're taking their children, many of them. We don't have any with us on this particular trip, but there are grandparents that are entertaining their grandchildren by going on a tour with them. It's a perfectly delightful life. And if you see the need, it doesn't have to be that you travel abroad or anything. You see the need of somebody learning how to embroider chicken scratching. Miss Thelma already knows how now. She's going to go home and teach all of her neighbors, I'm just sure. Because there is a need there of filling your
mind. My wife and I have been retired a number of years, and we have left our home for periods of time and come back. Last spring when I come back, it's a small rural community, strictly rural. Our big city consists of a couple of gas stations, a hardware and grocery store combination. And there's a little cafe there. But I found a number of hurting people in the community. We've had, in this kind of a rural setting, we've had 6 suicides in the last 2 years. We had a tragedy of a young mother and 2 children being murdered. And this fear, tenseness in the background, and this hurting person sitting here and another hurting person sitting there, and so forth. I went to our young pastor and suggested starting an interdenominational Bible study for the men, the retired men. There was already one for the women. And with the sole purpose of getting these men started on visitation to hurting people, even visiting one another. Now when we left, we still only had about 7 people attending, but I was very happy to see on the last Sunday I was at church, 2 of these men buttonhole a new widower and inviting him in and encouraging him for visitation. They themselves have already started visitation, even hospital visitation. So, but reaching out to hurting men.
Thank you for sharing that. You know, if you have from senior citizens clubs or whatever it is, you know, in the church, it's fine to come together and drink coffee, but we ought to be able to offer something more through our senior programs than simply drinking coffee and playing shuffleboard. Lena?
One of the things that I feel older people don't understand is that they have a much greater freedom to say what needs to be said. When you are dependent upon employers for your income and you are really quite vulnerable to being fired if you get out of line, quote unquote, you do have to watch what you do in a certain way. But when you're older and you have your retirement all set and you, people really can't cut you off at the pockets, as the saying goes, you really can say what needs to be said. And so to be the prophet, to be the one who speaks the hard word, who calls it as it is a marvelous mission. Now, of course, you get labeled eccentric, but it is a real freedom, I think, that is often not quite understood by older people.
Have you read?